Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 14th, 2024. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Looking at the front page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, more transparency coming to real estate market. The word transparency is in quotation marks. But recent national settlement may not bring drop in home prices. By Aaron Murphy, Gazette Des Moines Bureau. How realtors work with home sellers and buyers will change as the result of a recent $418 million national settlement with a large real estate group. But rapidly rising housing prices may not ease much or at all because of the deal, multiple Iowa realtors say. In class action lawsuits against the National Association of Realtors, home sellers argue that agents had been charging them excessive fees that drive up the cost of homes and helping steer buyers to more expensive homes that offer larger commission payouts. Home sellers have been compelled to set a high buyer broker commission to induce buyer brokers to show their homes to the buyer broker's clients, according to one of the plaintiff's lawsuits. As part of the settlement, the powerful national trade group said in March it would eliminate its rules on commissions and make other changes. One Iowa expert believes the deal will have substantial effects on the real estate industry, including the possible proliferation of brokers offering their services to sellers at discounted commission rates. While Eastern Iowa realtors say that commission rates have always been negotiable, the nationwide standard has been 5% or 6%, a fee charged to sellers that typically is split with a buyer's representative if there is one in the transaction. And that can be a substantial amount. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the median price of a home in the nation was $485,000 in February. At a 6% commission, that's over $29,000. The Trade Association agreed to require its realtors to enter into an agreement upfront that includes what services the agent will provide and for how much. The association also agreed to no longer require a realtor to make a compensation proposal to buyers and their agent to list the property on a multiple listing service or a database showing homes for sale. Compensation for that will now be up to the buyer, not the seller. The settlement is subject to court approval. If it is approved, it is expected to go into effect in July. Shainer Michaelhays, a Coralville realtor and president of the Iowa Association of Realtors, said since the settlement was announced, he has been attempting to calm other realtors to assure them that, in his words, the sky is not falling and that the changes outlined in the settlement could be good for their profession. What a lot of members are looking at is, oh my God, change. Change is horrible. And it's this negative thing. And yes, we're going to have to do business a little differently in various aspects. But you know, these are probably things that should have been done proactively anyway in the real estate industry, Michaelhays said. Michaelhays said having a signed agreement between a realtor and a home buyer is one example of an added level of transparency that could help improve the home buying experience. He said he has experienced home buyers, especially first timers, who are unaware of some of the basic elements of home buying and working with realtors, and that a signed agreement up front should help eliminate confusion or surprises. As an example, Michaelhays recalled working with a young couple who near the end of the process of buying a home suddenly became panicked about paying Michaelhays' commission, not realizing that fee was already worked into the purchase price. I think that's a great example of how that scenario should never occur, and without this requirement in place, there is the possibility that that does happen, Michaelhays said. And likewise, on the seller side, even though we've had listing agreements in place, this really emphasizes to all realtors that you need to have that conversation with sellers about, okay, here's how much I charge for commission, and there are various options. Gavin Blair, Chief Executive Officer of the Iowa Association of Realtors, said the settlement terms could be an uncomfortable change for some realtors, but he also said he feels that additional communication and transparency could help the process. Michaelhays said he is skeptical the settlement would have a measurable impact on home prices. He said he expects the same factors that have always driven home prices to continue. I'm not an economist, I'm just going by my own personal experience, but the thing that drives prices more than anything, and it's just basic economics, is supply and demand. I never, and I don't think any realtors, when they're pricing a home to list, give any consideration at all, zero consideration to what the commission was for that house when it sold last, what it's going to be. That is not a factor in deciding what a home should be priced at. It's based on comparable homes that have sold in the last few months, etc. Between January 2023 and January 2024, home prices grew nationally by 5.8%, according to an analysis by CoreLogic, a property information company. The average price in Iowa grew between 5 and 7%, roughly the national average, but more than in Minnesota and Nebraska, and less than in Illinois, Missouri, Wisconsin, and South Dakota. Despite all the ways the settlement will impact home buying and selling, Blair said he does not foresee major changes coming to the real estate market or for realtors. He agreed with Mogilhaes and others who say more transparency can be a good thing. I don't think it will significantly change that process. I think there will be a better understanding of it, Blair said. I think ultimately the buyer and the seller will fully understand better going into the transaction how this all works. I think at the end of the day, all this did was codify much more clearly the settlement piece, how real estate in practicality has worked, Blair added. But I think it's a better understanding for sellers and buyers to understand how everybody's getting paid in this deal. And I think it doesn't hurt to have that understanding be there from the very get-go. Also from the front page, CR Schools Envision Expansive New Career Programs by Grace King of the Gazette. Cedar Rapids students will graduate better prepared for high-wage, high-skill, and in-demand careers because of the academies and pathways soon to be coming to three of the district's high schools, educators say. The addition of college and career academies to Cedar Rapids high schools, starting with freshman academies launching in the fall of 2025, will bring real-world experience to classrooms that aligns with their future career interests. The change comes with proposed renovations to Jefferson, Kennedy, and Washington high schools. We can't launch something this transformational without having the facilities to support it. It is vital to the success of this program. There's potential for us to be the leader in our educational facilities, said Chad Schumacher, Cedar Rapids Schools Operation Director. Expanding college and career education has been a focus of Cedar Rapids school leaders for the last year to better prepare students for high-wage, high-skill, and in-demand careers after high school. The academies and pathways offered to students will be based on local workforce needs and what careers interest students. Adam Zimmerman, Executive Director of Innovation for the Cedar Rapids Community School District, said the goal is to have the academies, such as for advanced manufacturing, healthcare, agriculture, business, and financial services, identified by June 3rd. The school buildings will have to look and feel different, designed to match the programs the district will offer, Zimmerman said. Larson Construction was hired last week by the Cedar Rapids School Board to consult through the design, construction, and completion of renovations at three of the school district's high schools that will support college and career academies and pathways. The school district is preparing to launch freshman programs at the three high schools for the 25-26 school year. The academies will be small and supportive learning environments contained within a larger high school setting. The following year, the 26-27 school year, the district will launch academies for sophomores, juniors, and seniors at the schools. The plan is for Jefferson and Washington high schools to have academies where students take courses with a college and career theme for at least 2 years, taught by a team of teachers from different disciplines. Academies also have partnerships with local employers and bring in resources from outside the high schools. Kennedy High will offer a slightly different version of college and career education called Pathways. Pathways are a series of three or more courses with a specific college and career focus. Students in a pathway can take courses alongside peers with broader career interests for a more traditional high school experience. The career focus of the pathways and academies at each high school will be different. Students likely will be able to choose which career field they're interested in and attend a different high school than the one that's within their residential attendance boundary. Throughout a presentation of the plan last week, school board members were asked what they were excited about and what questions they had. We are making a promise to our families and our students that they will graduate high school with more than just a diploma, said school board president Cindy Garlock. We're being public and intentional about that. This is a big change. How do we bring our families, staff, and students on board so they understand this shift and why it's important? I'm excited about the intentional, innovative change, said school board member Marcy Roundtree. She said the academies and pathways will mean great things for students and will engage school staff and the community in an amazing way. It's the change that we need in this district, she said. A renewed focus on college and career education also is part of the district's strategic plan, approved in September 2023 by the school board. District leaders have set a goal of improving graduation rates by 10% and ensuring every graduate leaves with college credit or industry certification by May 2027. Additions to Cedar Rapids High Schools for career and technical education was one priority of the $220 million bond issue that voters turned down last November. Last month, a team of architects, including a representative from Larson Construction, toured all 32 schools in the Cedar Rapids system as the first step in creating a new facility plan before the district takes another bond referendum to voters, possibly in November 2025. Last fall, the school board approved a contract with Steel Dynamics Consulting Services to help develop a 3 to 5 year action plan to create college and career pathways. The $70,000 contract is being funded by a federal magnet schools grant the district was awarded last year. As part of this effort, a task force was created for strategic planning collaboration to provide input on 4 to 6 high-skill, high-wage, and high-demand career pathways that meet the demands of the Cedar Rapids area labor market, among other things. In an interview last year with the Gazette, Jay Steele, Chief Executive Officer and founder of Steele Dynamics, said hiring teachers with the experience and certification needed for programs such as engineering can be challenging. It can be a big pay cut for some people to leave their industry and go into teaching, he said. He encourages districts to work with leaders in industries. Some people who have had careers as engineers, for example, might be ready to retire from their field but want to keep working. Turning to the Iowa Today section and the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, Supreme Court hears abortion arguments. Lawyers for Governor Kim Reynolds argued before the Iowa Supreme Court on Thursday that a law banning abortions as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy should be allowed to take effect, while opponents pushed for the law to be permanently blocked. The law, passed by Republicans in a special session last year, would ban abortion once cardiac activity is detected in a fetus. It has been temporarily blocked by a district court. The arguments focused on which legal standard should be applied to the abortion ban. Since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, many state courts have applied the lower-level rational basis test to abortion laws, finding them constitutional. Abortion providers asked the court to apply the stricter undue burden standard, which would prohibit any law that places an undue burden on a woman seeking an abortion. Traffic camera regulations pass. After years of disagreements over how much to regulate traffic enforcement cameras in Iowa, Iowa House lawmakers passed a bill this past week requiring cities to receive state approval before installing speed and red light cameras. The bill must pass the Senate before being eligible to be signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. Illegal immigration a state crime. Iowa has joined Texas in making illegal immigration a state crime after Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill into law criminalizing illegal reentry. The bill would allow state law enforcement to arrest and judges to order the removal of immigrants who enter the country illegally after previously being denied entry or deported. Reynolds announces summer food program. Governor Kim Reynolds announced a $900,000 competitive grant program to address child food insecurity last week after turning down $29 million in federal support for the summer EBT program. The program will direct federal pandemic relief funds to create additional summer meal sites in underserved areas in the state. Critics said that the program comes short of meeting the need and is well below the millions in funding available from the federal government. They said the program will not address barriers to families seeking food assistance programs, like a lack of transportation to meal sites. Pipeline eminent domain rules advance. Iowa Senate lawmakers advanced a bill regulating eminent domain proceedings for carbon capture pipelines out of a subcommittee last week, marking the first time a pipeline regulation has advanced in the chamber. Opponents have argued that eminent domain should not be used for the private projects. Under the heading, they said, "Today the unborn had their day at the Iowa Supreme Court. As a pro-life governor, I will do everything I can to protect the innocent unborn and promote strong, healthy families." Governor Kim Reynolds on abortion law arguments. And, "Iowans value their freedom, and that includes the freedom to make decisions about their bodies and their health care with their doctors. A majority of Iowans oppose attacks on their health care choices." Senator Janice Weiner, Democrat, Iowa City, on abortion law arguments. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Judicial Nominating Rules, a proposal to give the Iowa governor more power over district judge appointments is moving forward in the Iowa Senate, but a key House Republican called the policy a non-starter. The proposal would remove the most senior judge in a district from the Judicial Nominating Commission and allow the governor to appoint an additional member. Iowa retires number 22. The University of Iowa will retire the number 22 jersey in honor of Caitlin Clark, Athletics Director Beth Goetz announced. The honor marks the end of Clark's college career before she enters the WNBA draft after smashing several college basketball records. Clark led the Hawkeyes earlier this month to the NCAA championship game, where they lost to South Carolina. Under the heading Water Cooler, Dubuque Homicide, 3 people are dead in an apparent domestic abuse situation in Iowa and Wisconsin, authorities said. Alexander Grunke of Middleton, Wisconsin, was identified as a shooter and killed himself after an armed standoff with law enforcement. A 13-year-old girl and a 32-year-old Dubuque County woman also were killed in the incident. Arming school staff. The Iowa Senate passed a bill that would create a permitting process for trained staff in Iowa schools to carry firearms. Republicans said the measure would increase school safety and allow quick response to active shooters, while Democrats argued it would make students less safe. Turning to the Insight page, we have a couple of guest columns under the heading A Taxing Debate. Tomorrow, of course, April 15th is tax day. The first guest column is from John Hendrickson. John Hendrickson is policy director for the Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation, and he writes, Iowa taxpayers deserve constitutional protection against higher taxes. It's funny that government can never afford to cut taxes or spending, but taxpayers are never asked whether they can afford higher taxes, stated columnist Cal Thomas. The voice of the taxpayer often is drowned out by special interests that demand greater spending. Senator Dan Dawson and Representative Bobby Kaufman, who chair the Ways and Means Committees of the Iowa Legislature, are pushing to ensure that taxpayers have lasting constitutional protections. As part of their tax reform proposal, Dawson and Kaufman have introduced two constitutional amendments that would place taxpayers before special interests. The first constitutional amendment would require a supermajority, or two-thirds vote, of both chambers of the legislature to approve an income tax increase. While this would be a strong taxpayer protection, it would not be unique to Iowa. Currently, 17 states have some form of supermajority requirement for tax increases, including seven with that protection enshrined in their constitutions. A supermajority requirement would also force the legislature to justify why a tax increase would be needed, and it would require bipartisan support to approve an increase. This would force the legislature to build a consensus to pass a tax increase. The second constitutional amendment being proposed would protect the flat tax. Under current law, Iowa will transition to a flat 3.9% income tax in 2026. This would prevent a future legislature from jettisoning the flat tax in favor of returning to a progressive tax system. Specifically, the amendment prohibits more than one income tax rate above zero. All taxpayers across Iowa benefit when there is a single low tax rate. Critics of these taxpayer protections argue that they will not only bind the hands of a future legislature, but they are only intended to protect the tax cuts enacted by the Republican legislature and Governor Kim Reynolds. States that have a supermajority requirement are diverse in terms of their political culture. California, which is hardly a bastion of conservatism, requires a two-thirds vote to increase taxes. Further, if a future legislature wants to increase the income tax, then we'll have to either build a consensus or have supermajority control of both chambers. During a Senate subcommittee hearing, Senator Jason Schultz described the amendments as a citizen wealth confiscation prevention amendment, which is an accurate description. Both amendments would help prevent not only a higher flat tax rate, the establishment of a progressive income tax, or the creation of a wealth tax. The debate surrounding these amendments also is part of the greater philosophical debate over fiscal policy. Do higher levels of spending and taxes create better services and an overall society? Iowa's current fiscal situation proves otherwise. Iowa's fiscal foundation remains strong as a result of conservative budgeting and prudent tax reforms. For the past several years, Iowa's budget has been in surplus, the reserve accounts are full, and the Taxpayer Relief Fund is approaching $4 billion. Plus, the state budget continues to grow, but not as fast as critics of the governor and legislature would prefer. Another key point that is forgotten is that the last several years have seen numerous states reduce their income tax rates. Iowa is in competition for both jobs and people, and tax rates matter, and a mass exodus is taking place in high-tax states such as Minnesota and California. In addition, states that continue to increase both spending and taxes are having the greatest budget problems. Does Iowa really want to become the next California or Minnesota? Finally, critics argue that amendments are anti-democratic. If the amendments make it to the ballot, Iowans will have the chance to approve or reject these measures. A majority of Iowans, close to 68%, support a supermajority requirement. Also, a Des Moines Register poll found that 62% of Iowans support gradually eliminating the income tax. The last several elections demonstrate that Iowans support the fiscal conservatism of Governor Reynolds and the legislature. Iowa taxpayers deserve constitutional protection. And the other guest column is from Mike Owen, Deputy Director of Common Good Iowa. And Mike Owen writes, Iowa lawmakers, our tax system is broken, let's break it some more. Forget the adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. In the Iowa legislature, it's different. We broke it, so let's break it some more and then make sure nobody can fix it. That, in short, is the picture of tax cut proposals gaining steam in Iowa. Deep income tax cuts passed in 2022 jeopardized 20% of the state general fund supporting education, Medicaid, mental health, corrections, child care, water quality, and public safety. Because the tax cuts are phasing in through 2026, Iowans haven't yet seen their impacts, masking damage their proponents won't admit. Now lawmakers are debating another round of income tax cuts that will hit harder, possibly as extreme as eliminating the individual income tax, which generated half the state budget when the latest cut started. It's full speed to the bottom. As if this were not bad enough, pending legislation would make the damage permanent and erode our ability to govern ourselves. A Senate resolution, SJR 2004, would set up a constitutional amendment requiring income tax rates to be the same for everyone regardless of income. A House resolution, HJR 2006, would require two-thirds majorities to raise those rates, a hurdle nearly impossible to meet. As few as 17 senators or 34 representatives could block any income tax increase. Passage this session would set up potential legislative votes, again in 2025 or 2026, that could put these ideas on the ballot in 2026. Both deny Iowa voters and the legislators they elect the opportunity to make their own decisions under principles of democracy, one person, one vote, and majority rule. They are bad ideas. It is not enough to say, let the voters decide. It is no less egregious for voters in 2026 to rip power from future voters and the people they elect than it is for legislators who are elected for 2 and 4 year terms. And it should not be harder to clean up a mess than to make one. The stakes are high. It is simply unquestionable that the current law now being implemented, let alone new proposals to accelerate and deepen tax cuts and even eliminate the income tax, will be disastrous for public services and tax fairness. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy has identified the 10 states with the most unfair state and local tax systems. 6 have no income tax, including neighboring South Dakota. 2 have a flat rate income tax. One of them is Illinois. At 23rd worst, Iowa is no bright light here. Like many states, we tax our lowest earners at the highest rates, but as long as we keep our moderately graduated rate income tax, the prospect of hitting the bottom 10 has been unlikely. That's because the income tax has partially offset the regressive nature of sales and property taxes that hit the poor the hardest. Instead of passing more tax cuts skewed to the wealthy and rising on that list of most unfair tax systems, we could make targeted tax changes to expand opportunity for working families. 1 in 6 Iowa working households don't make enough to get by without public supports. We could expand the earned income tax credit or create a meaningful, refundable child tax credit to help them succeed. Hopefully, Iowans will realize the stakes before we see the full effects of these plans. Families who can't take their child to the doctor because they were cut off Medicaid, more crowded classrooms because schools can't hire more teachers, even dirtier water because there's nobody to penalize polluters. Iowa can do better, but only with resources. Promises of economic growth through tax cuts make Iowa merely a petri dish for another failed experiment passing off politics as economics. Kansas saw it in recent years, reversing radical tax cuts after 5 years of damage, still attempting to recover. But the tax slashers persist. Where is their courage of conviction? Are they so lacking in confidence that they need to pass new cuts before those already passed have taken effect and lock their position in place with constitutional amendments? To disrespect democracy is to disrespect Iowans. That is fast becoming the legacy of the current legislative majority. Editorial fellow Chris Esperson writes an open letter to Iowa public schools. To the staff, administrators, and students of the Iowa public schools, words have been elusive this past week. I thought about writing about those who seek to harm you and the policies they are weaponizing to do so. Listening to Lauren Hill, I thought about titling this, The Miseducation of Iowa Youth, and describing all the lessons that they would have disappear from your curriculum. But I was temporarily paralyzed by everything happening in the world around you. Many of these things are happening not just around you, but to you. I thought instead about the joy and pain that reverberate in your hallways and classrooms and realized that sometimes love is the strongest power. So instead, I decided to write a love letter to you. I saw a post yesterday about a man who gives money away to strangers at a restaurant. He was inspired by his dying mother's note to him to love everybody. And this is what you do. Everyone is welcome in your halls. There are no entrance exams, exclusion criteria, or exorbitant fees to gain access. Many times when someone does leave for greener pastures, they come back. Sometimes because they realize the intangible benefits you provide, and other times they are invited to do so. These invitations come from the institutions who can't or won't put in the work for those with bonus needs. You have shown tremendous courage in standing up for those who continue to be othered. You have found ways to protect those who are being attacked, outed, and banned. You have found ways to teach the truth, to honor the vast contributions and complex history of all our children. You have done this despite gaps in traditional textbooks and current rules that seek to protect those who have doled their dirty pain out on others and enable their paranoia to impede progress. You may be asking what you have done to deserve this animosity, and you may still be struggling to find footing with rugs constantly being pulled from beneath you. Know that you are not responsible for their ignorance, and you don't deserve being set up to fail, and that you won't fail no matter what is thrown at you. You are not perfect, no one is, but you recognize you have room to grow and are committed to do so, and administrators are trying to remove outdated systemic barriers that have prevented you from having staff that reflect the different backgrounds and experiences that compose your student body. This will promote not only the growth of the students, but of your peers who need this diversity for their own personal and professional development, and to overcome their biases that have harmed some students. Money is tight. In some instances, it has become unnecessarily and unfairly so. You have depended on creative methods to balance budgets, and in many, many instances have had to make tough decisions. We hope the community can help fill some gaps while we await elections to choose more appropriate public servants who will use data to drive decisions instead of letting national fringe political groups take the wheel. The fear of mass violence has become a painful and dreadful reality this year. The drills that take away from lesson times did mitigate some loss of lives, but they were not enough to completely avoid tragedy. We feel your frustration over lack of prevention measures and surprise about proposed policies that may exacerbate the situation. Keep hope until common sense kicks back in. We will keep pushing for policy and action in addition to thoughts and prayers. You are the only institutions truly preparing our future to function in local and global societies. Your students are exposed to cultures, languages, and ideas that prepare them to challenge perceived limitations and expand frontiers of technology and understanding. They will solve the problems our generations have caused or contributed to. They will do so primarily because their exposure to different perspectives allows them to see things differently. Although private institutions do not have increased curriculum censorship as you do, you are finding innovative ways to help children find the truth. As a friend said recently, teachers in public schools are built different. The paychecks do not reflect the labor and love that goes into showing up in resource-constrained environments and in some places where they don't benefit from family involvement and support. Families in some districts have more social needs and barriers than others, and current funding does not fully account for these disparities. Teachers depend on donations and dig deep into their own pockets. Many stay late to support students and families or to staff school functions. They show up to cheer on sports teams and attend extracurricular events. Some of the people I admire the most and friends I hold closest to my heart emerged from your doors in rented graduation caps and gowns, and we have hope that those who continue to emerge from your institutions will put us back on a path of public school excellence and legislator support that mirrors that of the public. Stay strong. We see you. And turning to the community letters, and also today's editorial cartoon, the editorial cartoonist Joe Heller, based in Green Bay, we see a group of people around a table as if they were in a conference room at a board meeting with California $20 minimum wage on the table, and a man standing at the head of the table with a button that says CEO says, "Do you realize what this minimum wage increase means? I'm going to need a raise so I can continue making 400 times more than my employees." The first letter is from Susan Benderson of Cedar Rapids. "Medicaid extension doesn't feel like a win. I was really happy to hear that the Republican legislature voted to extend care for newborns and their mothers to 12 months under Medicaid. Infants deserve a healthy start in life, and babies and moms can have severe complications from pregnancy and delivery. So why am I so disappointed in this win for low-income families? Maybe it's just me, but it feels wrong that Iowa would lower the income eligibility when infant mortality numbers are up, and yet spend money on so-called clinics that provide pregnancy tests and ultrasound, dubious advice, and some freebies. Sink that money into real health care if you want women who can't afford the cost of having a child to have hope that the outcome of that pregnancy, wanted or not, is positive." Susan Benderson of Cedar Rapids. Next, Jeffrey Schaefer of Cedar Rapids writes, "Cameras don't ticket law-abiding citizens. Some individuals believe that automatic traffic cameras are unconstitutional because the car owner is fined even if the car owner is not driving. Using that logic, parking meter fines should be banned because the car owner is fined even if the car owner was not driving. Illegally parking in a handicapped spot also is unconstitutional because the fine is issued not knowing who the driver is. I personally do not understand the problem. There is nothing to worry about if you did not do anything wrong. The automatic traffic cameras business would not exist if everyone obeyed the speed limit. Until that happens, don't do the crime if you cannot pay the fine." Jeffrey Schaefer of Cedar Rapids. Next, John Voltz of Cedar Rapids writes, "Southern border is being invaded. For some time now, I have been wondering why our government hasn't stopped the invasion of our southern border. Now I'm beginning to see it as it is. More businesses are advertising on their storefronts in Spanish. Why do I have to press 1 on my phone for English? Why are states offering the written driving test in Spanish when all the road signs are in English? And now to vote in many states, you only have to show a driver's license. To the majority of voters in the next election, let me close with, we're all in Los Estados Unidos de America." John Voltz of Cedar Rapids. Next, Paul Melise, past president of the Iowa Woodland Owners Association of Iowa City, writes, "Bill threatens private woodland areas. Our current state legislature appears to be on the cusp of undoing 100 years of progress. At issue is the Forest and Fruit Tree Reserve Act, enacted by our forefathers in 1906 to provide a landowner property tax incentives to encourage landowners to hold their poorer lands in timber for erosion control, watershed protection, and game cover, all of which are even more important today than when enacted in 1906. At issue is HF 2672, which changes the minimum requirement from 2 acres to 5 acres and will give a county board of supervisors the authority to entirely opt out of the Forest Reserve Program in their county. HF 2672 was passed by the Iowa House and is currently awaiting consideration by the Iowa Senate. Please email or call your state senator and ask them to oppose HF 2672. The number for the Senate switchboard is 515-281-3116 or 515-281-3371. Paul Melise, past president, Iowa Woodland Owners Association of Iowa City. And the final letter from Sonia Ettinger of Iowa City, "Don't put business over science on pesticides." Congratulations for the recent series focusing on the abnormally high rate of cancer in Iowa. Recently, the Gazette followed up with a column and a letter on the subject of farm chemicals and pesticides, which are potentially toxic. The Journal of the National Cancer Institute reported elevated cancer biomarkers in the urine of people who also showed high glyphosate concentrations, April 3rd. In addition, Todd Dorman noted that the World Health Organization's International Research Agency on Cancer had stated some years ago that glyphosate is probably carcinogenic to humans. The University of Washington has found that long-term exposure to glyphosate increases the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Yet, ironically, the company that now makes it, Bayer, also is doing research on a treatment for this very disease. As a result, one could imagine that glyphosate could be a dangerous chemical. However, our Iowa legislature is currently considering a bill that would hinder Iowans' abilities to go to court to claim damages from the use of the product that may have harmed them. The GOP, the party of individual self-government, is once again aiming to control Iowans for the benefit of a big company. Is it possible that our legislators are not experts in science? Think of water pollution from nitrogen overflow that counties cannot legislate on, liquefied gas and pipes damaging farmers' land, and now farm chemicals. It is time to respect science and scientists, not just business. Sonia Ettinger of Iowa City. And some quotes of the week. First, Iowa basketball Caitlin Clark, reacting to the announcement her number 22 jersey will be retired. She said, "That number holds a lot of weight, far beyond my name. I'm just really grateful, and it'll be a special day when that happens for sure." Next, State Representative John Willis, Republican Spirit Lake, speaking in favor of an amendment banning the use of automated traffic cameras. Representative Willis says, "These cameras are not fair, and they're not something that we should be doling out justice in a way that is not fair to all of our citizens in this state. These traffic cameras are speed traps. I don't believe they're constitutional." Next, State Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat Cedar Rapids, speaking in favor of a bill that would regulate but not ban the use of traffic cameras. Representative Sheets says, "This technology not only saves lives by reducing high-speed accidents, but it also protects our first responders by minimizing risky traffic stops." Next, Sarah Montague McFarland, describing when she found out her husband, Robert McFarland, died from injuries after being attacked by inmates at the Anamosa State Penitentiary. And she has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections. Ms. McFarland said, "I dropped the phone and screamed no. My teen son screamed no. I just cried for a long time." And Taft Middle School science teacher Steve Kepke, describing his students witnessing a partial solar eclipse. He says, "You say something is going to happen and you can explain it, but it's nothing like experiencing it." You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 14th, 2024, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn to today's obituaries. Beverly Cadleck, a longtime Cedar Rapids resident, passed away peacefully on April 7th at the age of 93. Beverly was a member of the Scottish Highlanders, where she performed as a dancer and played bagpipes at Iowa football games. Beverly's musical talents became well known and led to a long career of teaching many Cedar Rapids children the love of music through the piano. She also was extensively involved in the creation and coordination of the Cedar Rapids All-City Music Contest. Service was a way of life for Beverly. She volunteered at Lovely Lane United Methodist Church in a variety of capacities, and she also volunteered at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library. A service will be held at a later time. Joel Everett Halterman, age 78, of Cedar Rapids, died December 31, 2023, in St. Louis, Missouri. The celebration of life and reception will be Saturday, April 20th, from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the American Legion, Post 298, 625 31st Street in Marion. Donna Lee Mullenix of Cedar Rapids passed away March 18th from the effects of scleroderma. A visitation will be held on Wednesday, April 17th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, 1844 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. There will be no funeral services. A celebration of life will be held on Sunday, September 22nd. Donna enjoyed cooking and loved to fish. She made several quilts for her children and grandchildren, along with others that needed one, most notably the quilts that were made for the Cedar Rapids Multiple Sclerosis Society. Donna worked at the A&W Root Beer Stand and Standard Appliance in her youth, then briefly at Iowa City Manufacturing. She moved on to Cryovac in Cedar Rapids, where she remained for 29 years until the plant closed down. Donna finished her career at the Abbey Center. Michael O'Donnell, known as Mike, age 75, of Lisbon, passed away unexpectedly on Wednesday afternoon, April 10th, at the St. Luke's Emergency Room. Visitation will be Friday, April 19th, from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Chapel Stateroom at Cedar Memorial. Funeral services will be held Saturday, April 20th, at 11 a.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, with visitation 1 hour prior to the services. Burial will follow the service and take place at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Mausoleum. Mike began his 43-plus year career with the Seedoff Masonry, Inc. out of Strawberry Point. He was a real asset to the company and took great pride in his work. He started as a bricklayer, then a foreman, and ended his career as an area superintendent in the Des Moines area. Mike and his wife kept rental properties as well as their own homes and yards in pristine condition. Mike was always a car fanatic and enjoyed watching NASCAR and was a number one fan of John Force Racing. David Eugene Markham of Cedar Rapids passed away December 1st, 2023, of a broken heart following the loss of his cherished wife and soulmate, Beth. He was born April 14th, 1962. David worked for a time as a diesel mechanic before he gravitated to continue working with his hands and his heart as a bus driver and custodian until his retirement in 2018. David approached life with an innate curiosity, even in his last year of life, taking a bass guitar lessons that ended with him picking up a guitar and playing before the lesson could begin. Private burial will be at Jordan's Grove Cemetery in Central City. Terry Michael Schnebelin, age 76, of Center Point, passed away on April 8th in his home. A memorial service will be held April 20th at 11 a.m. at Anchor Bible Church, 275 Green Street West, Center Point. Visitation will precede the service at 10 a.m. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point assisted the family. Terry worked as a machinist for many years and also enjoyed playing guitar and singing as a member of Hard Times, a popular local band in the 70s. He always had a project going in the garage, and his ingenuity and skill produced some invention that may have warranted a patent. He also loved football season, chocolate, and most of all, his family. Donald H. Meek, age 82, of Cape Coral, Florida, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away peacefully on Saturday, March 30th, at Hope Hospice Care in Cape Coral after a long battle with congestive heart failure. Don was a very proud Navy veteran who always had a great love for the U.S. military. He partnered with two of his friends in the 70s to start a home building company, AABI. Don later became president of the Home Builders Association. He then opened his own home building company, DMB, or Donald Meek's Builders, in the early 80s started a masonry restoration company, TSS, Technical Specialty Systems. In the mid-80s, Don focused solely on TSS, where he served as president owner and was still hands-on until the time of his death. Don also managed the Meek family farm, which had been in the family for over 125 years. A celebration of life will be held at a date and location to be determined in the coming months. Dennis Edward Morrissey, age 74, of Hiawatha, passed away Sunday, April 7th at the Iowa City VA Medical Center following a heroic 50-year battle against type 1 diabetes. A memorial mass will be held on Tuesday, April 16th at noon at St. Patrick Catholic Church by Father Dennis Miller and concelebrant Father Ivan Newhouse. Friends may visit with the family on Monday, April 15th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Tien Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Dennis was an Army veteran serving from 1971 to 1977. In 1975, Dennis began working for the U.S. Postal Service and retired enviably in 2004 on his 55th birthday. He was a member of the Knights of Columbus and St. Patrick Catholic Church. He selflessly donated his body to the University of Iowa so that researchers might learn more about type 1 diabetes. Jane Ann Schmidt, age 69, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on March 22nd at Aldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Memorial service 11 a.m. Saturday, April 20th at New Covenant Bible Church in Cedar Rapids. June was a choral music director for 40 years. Over the years, she taught students at Shellsburg, Benton Community, Linmar. After her retirement from teaching in 2016, she acted as CARES ministry director at New Covenant Bible Church. June was a remarkable woman who loved deeply and gave her time selflessly. She loved Jesus and lived her life as a reflection of his perfect love for her. Her life can be characterized by this quote, "A man should hear a little music, read a little poetry, and see a fine picture every day of his life in order that worldly cares may not obliterate the sense of the beautiful which God has implanted in the human soul." Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Peggy Jean Turner, age 83, of Miami, Florida, passed away April 3rd at Baptist Hospital in Miami. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, April 17th at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Funeral service 11 a.m. Wednesday, April 17th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Peggy had worked as a typist at Collins Radio and as a receptionist at FIU. She loved baking, sewing, crafting, and watching her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Peggy was a member of Killian Pines United Methodist Church in Miami, Florida. Robert Thompson, age 93, passed away at Sanford Hospital in Fargo, North Dakota. Bob served in the Army, Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri, as a training drill staff sergeant. Bob taught industrial arts in Van Horn, Iowa from 1955 to 1960, Belplaine from 1960 to 1961, and Cedar Rapids, Jefferson, where he taught woodworking and carpentry for 32 years from 1963 to 1995. Bob loved fishing in Minnesota, golfing, boating, and woodworking, and was an avid Hawkeyes fan. Father Eugene C. Cooch, age 96, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, April 10th at the Stonehill Center in Dubuque. A scripture wake service will be held at 3 p.m. Tuesday, April 16th at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, followed by visitation until 7 p.m. Massive Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, April 17th at St. Anthony Catholic Church, celebrated by Archbishop Thomas Zincula and priests of the Archdiocese of Dubuque. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Father Cooch served as pastor at St. Jude's Church in Cedar Rapids from 1976 to 1987. Jeff A. Port, age 68, of Castle Rock, Colorado, passed away Friday, April 5th. Jeff was a carpenter for 50 years. After moving to Colorado, he started his career with C&G Woodworking, making custom cabinetry, and working on multi-million dollar homes in the Douglas County and surrounding area. Jeff's hobbies included watching NASCAR races, big fan of Dale Earnhardt No. 3, Cheesehead, Go Packers. He enjoyed golfing, camping, fishing, and hunting while living and growing up in Iowa. Bobby Shaheen, age 72, of Hiawatha, passed away from cancer on April 10th, surrounded by her loved ones. Bobby worked at Collins Aerospace for 29 years until her retirement in 2018. Bobby loved gardening, spending time outside, and watching crime shows. She was happiest when surrounded by her family and her dogs, Sox, Copper, Lucky, Bailey, and Izzy. Those who knew Bobby knew she hated being fussed over and knew she would rather give than receive. She asked that her remains be scattered in some of her favorite places in a private ceremony. Khalil Ajram, age 86, of Cedar Rapids, passed away March 23rd. In agreement with his wishes and in accordance with his religious requirements, a burial service was held on March 24th. A memorial gathering will be held on Saturday, May 4th at the Islamic Center of Cedar Rapids, located at 2999 First Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids, where family and friends are invited to meet from 3 to 5 p.m. While working a couple of odd jobs, Khalil decided to enroll in an upholstery class at Kirkwood Community College and then opened his business, Ajram Upholstery, in 1969, in what would become a lifelong endeavor and passion until the day of his passing. His business was more than a business, as evidenced by the number of relationships he built and the constant memories created and shared with those who frequented Ajram Upholstery, from the mail service carriers, city workers, customers, and many others who became a part of his daily life. Tony Lee Smith, age 69, loving grandmother, mother, sister, and aunt and friend, passed away April 6th at St. Luke's Hospital. Celebration of life May 5th, 2024, at Thomas Park Shelter. Tony loved visiting, sharing memories, and hanging out with family and her many friends. Tony was funny and witty and loved to laugh. She enjoyed cooking and playing cards, especially skip-bow. She also loved to kick back and watch TV and was a lifelong fan of The Young and the Restless. She always had to have her Pepsi and ice and would never turn down a taco. Tommy James Thomas was tragically taken away on April 2nd due to injuries received from a motor vehicle accident. A celebration of life will be held in honor of Tommy on Saturday, April 20th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Wildcat Golf Course, 100 Wildcat Trail, Shellsburg, Iowa. Turning to the sports page, Iowa spring football. Early optimism about Iowa's offense. But spring hope in Iowa City has not always led to fall results. By Josh Stepp of the Gazette. John Stepp. Iowa's offense has created some confusion in practices. A good type of confusion. They got us thinking a lot more out there, defensive end Max Llewellyn said of the offense this week. A lot of motions, RPOs, all that jazz, so we kind of got to have all the areas of the field covered. The talk from Llewellyn and many others on both sides of the football about the Iowa offense's pre-snap motion and RPOs, run-pass option plays, are early signals of what could be a different-looking Iowa offense in 2024. A lot of the motions we make, it definitely sets off the defense in a way that just like that, real quick, we get certain different answers, wide receiver Caleb Brown said. So it's definitely fun to pick apart the defense. The new wrinkles have made the offense a little more complicated than what we're used to, facing as defense, safety Xavier Nwamka said. It's been a new, really creative offense, in my opinion, similar to the Packers, cornerback John Nestor said. They keep you on your toes every play. The offense's RPO threat, as defensive lineman Aaron Graves sees it, has forced the defense to get better at transition rushing. It's been a lot harder for us, especially the interior guys, to get sacks this spring ball because of that, Graves said. However, quarterback Deacon Hill wouldn't say we're like super RPO heavy. We have a couple here and there, Hill said. It just adds another level to the offense, another phase, I guess you could say. In terms of personnel groupings, tight end Luke Lachey said the offense has been doing a lot of 12, a lot of 11, some 13 now. The offensive line has made some adjustments as well. I don't want to spoil the party too much, but if you look at some NFL offenses in terms of how they run those plays, I think that's where things are a little bit different, offensive lineman Nick DeJong said. If you ask, are you still running outside zone? Yes. Are you still running inside zone? Yes. One of the questions going into Tim Lester's hiring was how much freedom would the offensive coordinator have to make necessary changes. The offense, Hill said Thursday, is kind of Lester's show right now, while Kirk Ferentz has been with the O-line like he always is. Hill's indications align with what Ferentz said at the end of last month about Lester's transition. Iowa is taking his playbook material and going with it. It's going to look different, but I think philosophically we're in line, Ferentz said at the time. Of course, optimism about the offense, if not a new concept at this time of year in Iowa City. Take what punter Torrey Taylor said almost exactly 2 years ago as an example. There might be a few less punts this year from the way things are going, Taylor said on April 12, 2022, and there's certainly a lot more balls in the end zone from what I've previously experienced. The NFL-bound punter's comments preceded a season in which the Hawkeyes ranked 120th or worst nationally in points per game, yards per play, third down efficiency, and other metrics. Media were allowed to see the first 20 minutes of practice Thursday, but that is a particularly small sample size, less time than it takes for an airline to board a flight, and a portion of that window was devoted to punting work. The Hawkeyes' open practice on April 20th will be the first extended look at the Lester offense. Even then, it will carry a few asterisks. Quarterback Cade McNamara has been limited in practices as he continues his injury recovery, prompting Hill to take first-team reps. Hill is among the players learning three offenses in the last 3 years. The ex-Badger worked in Wisconsin offensive scheme in 2022, Brian Ferentz's scheme in 2023, and now Lester's scheme in 2024. When looking more closely at the Wisconsin situation, it's more like four offensive schemes in 4 years because the Badgers did add some new stuff when Bobby Engram came in as offensive coordinator in 2022. It does get a little bit easier when Hill is so familiar with the unfamiliarity of learning a new scheme. Conceptually, there's not a ton of stuff you can do differently from a bunch of other schools, Hill said. The verbiage is different. How you want to motion is different. The verbiage is definitely probably the hardest part because last year we were all numbers. This year we're all words. Whether it be with numbers or words, the new look offensive brain trust embrace of RPO and motions may seem like bad news for Iowa's defense in the spring. Oh yeah, it's annoying, Llewellyn said from the defensive perspective. I hate it. It's awful, but got to do it. How good will the news be for Iowa's offense starting on August 31st? Time will tell. And that is the first Iowa football game of the year. It'll be August 31st versus Illinois State. And the next game after that on September 7th will be Iowa State. Flipping back to the Insight page, we have a guest column from Kurt Ulrich, who lives in rural Jackson County. And he writes, a beautiful, wild chorus welcomes the eclipse. It's not quite the world of Maurice Sendak out here, but on some days it feels close. A few days back, my cats and I awoke to the sound of birds, specifically robins, hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of them, filling in a field in front of my house, sitting in branches of trees in my hollow, all singing a constant, comforting chorus, eating grit from the gravel on my lane, grazing in the grass, and drinking, bathing, and just generally cavorting in a large puddle that forms after every rain. Clearly, the huge flock was simply passing through on its way to somewhere north of here, somewhere where food is plentiful. I'd recommend Minneapolis for the culture, but I expect that suggestion wouldn't fly. My cat Luna has never really much cared about what is happening in the outside world on any given day, a feeling I share, but the heavenly multitude of robins got her attention. All day long, she kept returning to the front window, chittering and twittering at the visitors. By day's end, all of the robins were gone. Other creatures have made themselves known this past week. The other night at dusk, three turkey vultures circled overhead as I walked from the house to my garage. I actually looked up and said to them, "Unless you know something I don't, I'd suggest you search for a meal elsewhere." They moved on. Of course, this past week, a solar eclipse has been all of the news. I'd planned to ignore it, you know, catching the highlights on television, wondering why so many people enjoy gathering in large groups or flocks. Then a gator ride out to my pond convinced me to pay attention to the eclipse. Hundreds and hundreds of small chorus frogs called spring peepers were hanging about, raising their little voices, singing so loudly that I could hear them over the sound of my gator's internal combustion engine. Riding up a steep, rocky hill through woods toward the pond during the eclipse was magical, and I wanted to see if the local wild things would change their behavior, perhaps quiet a bit. Just the opposite happened out here, as the more the sun was covered, the louder the peepers became, joined by cardinals, a turkey, a coyote, and a mourning dove, a beautiful chorus by those that share this land with me. The music raised me up, not high, but just enough to float above the earth. All across North America, we hoped for this raising up, this ability to look to the sky for inspiration, for something bigger than ourselves. For a little while, as the moon crossed the sun, the light changed, particularly as it filtered through trees, seemingly shifting and shimmering, causing shadows to appear to float slightly above the ground. It was a distinctly Monet light, and my pond was, for a few brief moments, a flowerless poor man's Giverny. During the eclipse, I sat in my gator above the pond, listening, looking around, reading a bit of poetry, but mostly being in the moment. The urge to glance at the sun was almost too much to overcome, but overcome I did, as that way lay madness and blindness. I was reminded of a quote I heard recently, words spoken by a character named Dmitri in Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov. He spoke not of an eclipse, but of our need to believe in things we cannot see or truly understand, like love, perhaps God, when he said, "I can see the sun, but even if I cannot see the sun, I know that it exists. And to know that the sun is there, that is living." And so it was. And finally for me today, The Time Machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Taking pictures, seducing bees. Two Cedar Rapids men knew what to do in 1897. By Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Louis Horsky was well known in Cedar Rapids in the 1890s. He owned a newspaper and cigar stand where local men would gather in the evenings to talk baseball. He was also a veteran firefighter of the 1st Ward Hose Company, using a filigreed silver trumpet to bark orders during fires. One man who rarely missed stopping by to see Horsky for a few minutes every day was Alphonse Franchere, co-owner of the Fair Department Store at 208-226 First Avenue Southeast. Franchere was a baseball enthusiast who built Athletic Park at the corner of 10th Street and C Avenue Northwest. The park lasted for 12 seasons from 1896 to 1909. He also liked to go hunting in the unsettled countryside around Cedar Rapids, which had a population of 18,000 in 1890. Another man who liked hunting outside the city was Sam Ho, an early and prolific amateur photographer. Ho took a myriad photos in and around Cedar Rapids in the 1890s, at a time when not many people had a camera. One of his photos in 1896 showed the new baseball park Franchere built in northwest Cedar Rapids. He also took portraits of the 1890s baseball team in the city. An August 11, 1896 Gazette news item reported Ho was on a railroad excursion to Waterloo. He had with him his Kodak and, besides taking a number of views on the Cedar River, took several groups of the picnickers. Two of Ho's photos, one of the day bees descended on Cedar Rapids, showed up in an old envelope in the Gazette's archives. Ho took the photos June 18, 1897, in downtown Cedar Rapids, the day bees were swarming high above the Grand Hotel, 302 First Avenue Southeast. Three electric streetcars met at 1st Avenue and 2nd Street Southeast. Observers thought the clanging of the cars brought the swarm of bees down into the crowd on the street, causing some panic. Horsky, who knew bees don't sting when they are swarming, found a small tree branch and held it steady in front of him as the bees circled around. Eventually, a few bees alighted on the branch. Then more came. After about an hour, the branch was covered with bees. Horsky gently placed the branch in a cracker box. His hand still was covered with bees when he placed a lid on the box. He wasn't stung. Ho caught the bee whisperer on film. One photo shows Horsky holding the branch to attract the bees. The other shows him putting the branch into a cracker box with an assist from Gazette editor Fred Folks. The next day, a mischievous for sale ad ran in the Gazette. A fine swarm of bees for the benefit of the home for the friendless. Call it Gazette office or on Lewis Horsky, corner of 5th Street and A Avenue. Horsky died of a severe attack of tonsillitis from which he suffered intensely for a long time, according to the August 27, 1900 Gazette. He was 44. He left behind his wife, Helen, and 5 daughters, Lillian, Libby, Helen, Bess, and Minnie. His funeral was held at the family home at 119 5th Street Northeast. As for the photographer, he left Cedar Rapids in 1898 to run a mercantile store in Jerome in South Central Iowa, his wife Effie's hometown. He returned to the city in 1902 because of ill health, but lived another 3 decades, dying in November 1934 of a heart attack while shoveling snow in front of his 3rd Avenue Southwest home. He was 77. That brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 14th, 2024. I have been selecting and lightly editing the articles from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I am your reader, Sharon Feltudo, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments, and thank you for listening.